to climb as well as I did in the finals and make a podium as well felt like the culmination of like almost a decade of really, really hard work. Having an eating disorder felt mandatory in the sport. In tears the whole time, went out to climb, didn't do well in the speed round, and like ultimately made the decision that I would.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not Real Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Jenny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest for today, Campbell Harrison. Campbell represents Team Australia and is one of the Oceania region's top competitors for moving on to the Olympics in the boulder and lead combined category. He also recently got elected to the IFSC Athletes Commission. So in this episode, we'll talk about causes he'd like to champion through that, what it's like competing as an Australian, and he also opens up about his past struggles with eating disorders, as well as why he was partially missing in Olympic qualifiers in 2020. Hope you enjoy this episode with Campbell. Yeah, you just came off of a really busy season, so how's it going?
Yeah, good. It's still going at this point. We've got kind of the biggest event of the year coming up in 3 weeks or so, the Continental Olympic Qualifier for the Oceania region. So officially qualified for that event, I'm on the start list, and now the kind of final preparations begin for what should be an interesting and exciting and terrifying experience.
Congrats. Yeah. What's the, can you remind us of the dates again?
Oh, I think it is the 24th and 25th of November. Yeah. Yeah. We've got the finals are on the 25th on the Saturday. So that'll be when the, Olympic ticket gets crowned for the Australia, New Zealand region.
Looking forward to that. How are you feeling for it?
Yeah, really good. Selection events. We had two separate selection events, a lead one and a boulder one, and I got first in the lead and second in the boulder. So I'm going into the event as the first place seeded athlete. And yeah, shape feels really good. Feeling quite consistent, which is really nice. And that's kind of all you can really hope for. I think that's going to be the kind of the main game of this one, is maintaining that consistency across the two disciplines to, you know, hopefully for me, I think it's going to be more a matter of keeping up in bouldering, and then hopefully I can score some extra points in lead that will make the difference and, fingers crossed, take the ticket.
Yeah. Well, we're all rooting for you. That'll be really exciting. Yeah. And I definitely want to get into that a little bit more in a bit. But yeah, I think it'd be great if we just got to know you a little bit first in general. Well, actually, so first of all, I think this is just like top of mind for me right now, because I just had my interview with Matt Groom lately, and some people were also curious about the commentary that you've done co-commentating. Which World Cups did you co-commentate on?
This year, I just did Briançon for the finals. But I've done lots and lots over the years, actually. I think like in 2017, I did a bunch. 2016, I think I did some as well. So kind of like over the years, I've done lots of different events. And it's always been like so much fun for me. And I think it's something like outside of climbing, like sports broadcasting is really interesting to me. And I really enjoy like getting behind the mic and experiencing it from that side of things.
So it's like something that you're maybe interested in pursuing in the future?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like if I retired tomorrow and the IFSC live stream commentator gig was up for grabs, like I would have my name in the ring for sure. I think it's so much fun and like kind of a dream post-athletic career, or one of a few. But yeah, I really enjoy it every time I get the opportunity to do it.
What's your experience like in the commentary box as, I guess, an athlete? And is it like, do you find it stressful, or is it like a smooth experience for you?
It's not super stressful for me, I think, especially when I'm not anchoring the cast. Like I've done a few for national competitions where like I'm in charge, and that can be a little bit stressful sometimes. I think by doing the commentary, I've definitely developed some empathy for commentators for the details they miss and the mistakes they make. Like you would never think it, but you've just got so much going on in your head. You're always thinking of like what to say next. It's so easy to like forget that, oh, this isn't the hype way of the route. Like someone else actually did an extra move, or especially in bouldering when there's so much going on, like, you know, you might have a commentator say, oh, it's our first top of this boulder when someone else has already topped it. But that's because not only are they tracking between 4 to 8 different climbs at the same time, but they've also got someone, you know, yabbering away in your ear, telling you when the ad breaks are going to be. You'll have maybe 1, 2, even 3 different screens or sheets of paper with information in front of you. Just so much coming in all at once. So it is really easy to make mistakes, but it also keeps it really exciting.
So like as a co-commentator for IFSC, you don't have to deal with any of the extra noise and voices in your ears?
Not as much. Like you still have some of the voices and the details and things, but I think at the end of the day, like if you mess up, it's not really on you, I guess. So it's a little bit less stressful. But you also have like an opportunity to like impart some new knowledge. You know, most, even a commentator like Matt, you know, won't necessarily have that like firsthand information of what it's like to be behind the wall and what it's like to go through the process of a World Cup as an athlete. So, it's fun to share that side of it as well in a way that doesn't always, you know, viewers at home don't always get to experience it like that. So that's quite nice as well.
Did you find that you had any like go-to phrases like Matt does when you're doing the full commentary?
Oh gosh, I probably do. I'm sure if I went back and listened, there's probably things that I would repeat. Not that I can think of off the top of my head, but I do remember, like from doing, I did a youth nationals event where I was commentating for 3 days in a row, and you do just start to feel like a bit of a robot, just saying the same things again and again and again. So I'm sure there's stuff in there that other people would pick up on that I'm not noticing. But in the moment, you're just like trying to think of interesting things to say that you've kind of already said for the last however many hours.
Yeah. Couldn't bear to watch it back.
Oh, yeah. No one likes to hear their voice on tape. So,
I get that. It's the worst. You were commentating already a bit in 2016, 2017. So you've kind of been on the scene for quite a while. How old were you when you first started climbing and like first started competing?
Yeah, so I first started climbing, I think I was around 8 years old. And at that point, it was just for fun. I think as a kid and even as an adult, I've been like super into video games, especially like as a kid, I was obsessed with the Tomb Raider series. And I think in my mind, I connected Tomb Raider with rock climbing. So I thought like it would be a fun little sport for me to do because like I was a pretty athletic kid in that I could run and I was strong, but like didn't really connect with ball sports. I wasn't super coordinated at them. So I thought I'll give climbing a go for whatever reason. And just like fell instantly in love with it. And just over time started climbing more and more and more. Thought I was really good at it. Started doing competitions, realized I was actually not that good at it. And like that really lit a fire underneath me that I'd never really experienced before. I think I started training really hard and saw the gains, like saw the benefits, saw how fast I was improving, and just got like totally addicted to that experience. And then that developed into a real like ambition to pursue excellence within climbing, I guess. So I started doing my first international competitions in 2012 when I was like 14, 15. And then progressed onto the senior circuit sort of through 2015, 2016, and have competed on the World Cup circuit pretty much every year since then. And I think, the like improvement I've made from coming like at the very bottom of the pack at my first World Cups to like now being able to make semifinals you know, more than once in a season, I've like really enjoyed that experience. And I think for me, that's like a huge draw card of climbing is just, yeah, like I really enjoy that competitive side, and I really enjoy just pushing my limits and like, you know, always chasing the next thing.
Yeah. So you went from youth to the internet or the adult circuit. Like, how do you determine when you're ready to go into like the adult portion?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't even know if you could say that I was ready when I did. I think especially when you're competing somewhere like Australia, they're kind of isn't, if you want to compete internationally, you've got like the one competition a year at World Youth Championships. And then there's not really anything else. Like, we don't have a youth series, like a continental youth series. The competitions within like the domestic calendar can be a little bit sporadic sometimes. So if you want to keep pushing the limits, then the Senior World Cup circuit is kind of the thing that you've got, or at least it was when I was sort of making that transition. And I think I just knew that competing on the World Cup circuit was my dream and my goal within the sport. And so I just decided that that was what I was going to do, I guess. And I think initially it was like super terrifying and super overwhelming. And, you know, I definitely wasn't competitive by any stretch. But, you know, if you want to accomplish something, like the first step to getting that, to making that goal, is trying. You know, you're never going to win a World Cup if you never enter a World Cup. So I guess I just decided I had to take that leap and make it happen and see where it goes.
So was it as simple as just like deciding that you're going to sign up for the other one?
No, I guess not. Like, there is qualification process, of course. Like, you have to be able to be competitive nationally. Like, for instance, I was still, I think I won my first senior nationals in 2015. So by being consistently competitive on the national circuit, I was qualified for the international circuit. So obviously, you know, you have to qualify, you have to have those results domestically. You also have to save a lot of money. I think I've, you know, all through high school, I had a part-time job and I was just saving and not really spending any of it. So there's also the financial side of things as well. That's like a big barrier. But you know, once you have accomplished those things, yeah, it's just a matter, I guess, of like putting in the work, being brave and taking the leap, I guess.
So just for like the travel costs and the fact that it goes all around the world, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Like, my first big World Cup trip was like over 3 months of being in Europe overseas with some of my other teammates, traveling all around. So yeah, the cost adds up pretty quickly, and I didn't have any kind of like financial sponsorship or support at that time as well. And the Australian team is like totally self-funded. So yeah, the financial side of things is definitely like a big barrier that you have to be ready to tackle. And there are like a lot of sacrifices, I think, that come into making that happen. So yeah, I talk about jumping onto this World Cup circuit like it's simple, but maybe that's just because it's such a priority for me that it's like, you know, in my mind, I was like, well, that's the thing I'm going to do. So I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. But ultimately, yeah, it's like quite a heavy involved decision, just, you know, putting aside the resources to even think about, you know, heading over there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like a huge sacrifice in terms of everything, like money, your time, what you dedicate your energy towards. It's a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that was something that maybe set me apart from some of my other competitors when I was young, was that I was very open and forward about climbing being my priority. Even with like school teachers and things that would be like, why haven't you finished your homework? And it's like, well, be honest with you, like, my priority wasn't finishing my homework. My priority was finishing my training. And, you know, that's maybe not everyone's way of looking at things, but it's definitely like how I decided to tackle it. And I think that's part of why I've been able to kind of make climbing my job, is that even before it was actually like a job, you know, you have to treat it as such and, you know, take yourself and it very seriously.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess from being on the youth circuit and the adult circuit, how do you feel like you've grown throughout those years?
Oh God, so much. Like, I'm definitely a completely different person to what I was when I was, you know, starting out. I think, I don't know, being on the World Cup circuit, especially heading over there a lot of the time alone as like the only Australian, I got these like really unique opportunities to mix with a whole bunch of climbers from a whole different, you know, a bunch of different countries, and really just like learn so much. And it totally changed my work ethic as an athlete and, you know, my capacity to be independent, and not to mention, you know, my climbing itself, like my climbing ability and my approach to my training, where I was able to grow a lot from those experiences, I think. And yeah.
How did you feel like emotionally going through those times? Because it's really hard as a kid, I'm sure. I like have seen just like youth competitions and you can like feel the air there. Like there's so much stress in the air. And then afterwards, everyone's like crying and it's just like, it doesn't really feel great being there. Do you feel like there's a big emotional difference between how you perceived it as a youth versus an adult?
Oh yeah. You talk about crying at competitions, and I, as a kid, definitely did my, or as a teenager, definitely did my fair share of crying at competitions. I think when I was starting out, when I was younger, it had more of a like be all and end all feeling to it. Competition climbing, you know, if one competition went bad, I remember this one competition. It was right before I headed over to my first sort of World Cup circuit, and I came second in a senior comp. And I remember just like standing in the shower, sobbing. So I was like, oh my God, I'm not ready. And I look back and I'm like, you know, I don't think like there were so many factors that played into me coming second in that event. But you know, as a young person, I just wasn't really able to like look at the whole picture like that. It was just, you know, if you're not first, you're last, kind of failure sort of mentality. And it was definitely, you know, I definitely had its lows and its highs. There were some times where doing it all and committing to it all has been really, really hard. And then there are other times where it like pays off and it feels like it's, you kind of trick yourself into feeling like it's been easy the whole time.
It sounds, kind of dramatic with the shower. It's like just standing in there crying, thinking that it's the end of the world. Imagine.
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, when you're in your teens, it can feel like that sometimes. It can all feel like the end of the world. But, you know, you get older and you grow up and you start to, yeah, be able to conceptualize things a little bit more. And I think you see like all the competitions that you've done in the past and then all the competitions you have yet to do in the future. And it's a lot easier to look at it as just like one piece of a greater puzzle. Whereas, you know, when it's kind of your first just stepping onto the scene, it can kind of feel like, you know, this is the moment, like this is the only moment. This is everything that your life has kind of come to. And then, you know, I'm 26 now, I'm like not old by any means, but old enough to kind of realize, oh, like I've been competing for 11 years now and, you know, probably competing for a, you know, good few more years to go. So it's like, it's kind of all just part of the journey.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Yeah, absolutely. And so previously you also mentioned that oftentimes you would be like the only Australian at the World Cups. And so kind of just wanted to dive into climbing in Australia since it's still, I guess, sort of a developing sport there. Well, I guess, first of all, you just came off of the National Bouldering or the Bouldering Nationals. And I saw you took a really big fall. That shocked me. That's like the biggest fall that I think I've seen in a competition recently. I'll link it in the show notes for everyone to see. But yeah, in general, how did it go?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you mentioned that fall. That was definitely the biggest fall I've ever taken in climbing, like comp or otherwise. And it was pretty scary. Coming into this competition, had some pretty big goals. I think Boulder Nationals had kind of always gone badly for me. I feel like I'd had really great performances on sort of all levels of the domestic circuit. I'd like won team selection events and things like that. But then when Boulder Nationals came around, I'd never been able to even make finals. I think my best result was like 8th. So I definitely felt like a little bit of pressure going into this event that I was putting on myself to like be able to sort of break that curse, I guess. But yeah, I think this event was like one of those bouldering events where I feel like my kind of headspace was at its best. My physical shape was probably the best it's been for bouldering. And yeah, was just like able to be really consistent throughout the rounds. And so when I like finished my semifinal and knew that I was progressing to the next round, like that was a really emotional experience. And then yeah, to climb as well as I did in the finals and make a podium as well felt like the culmination of like almost a decade of really, really hard work on probably my less proficient discipline, you know, of the two. So yeah, it was a really like emotional experience. And I think I surprised myself in a lot of ways, like, you know, regarding the massive fall I took on the second finals boulder. Like I was super rattled and super scared, and then still managed to like pull back on and top of the boulder. And I was the only person in the round who managed to finish that block. And so, yeah, it was that comp was a big moment for me. And like something I think I'll be proud of for a really long time.
Yeah. Is bouldering something that you actually enjoy competing in, or are you kind of just doing it because of the whole combined format?
Oh, no, I really love bouldering. Okay. And I really love competing in bouldering. I think bouldering has definitely changed a lot in the time that I've been competing. And I think maybe sometimes it doesn't feel like quite like the sport that I initially signed up for. And I think that's why I gravitate towards lead a little bit more. It's a little bit more classic in terms of the elements of climbing that I really resonate with and that got me into the sport. But no, I do really enjoy bouldering. I just think on an international level, I would like to be a little bit more competitive than I am, I think. Whereas in lead, I feel like I'm continually progressing. So I probably err towards that discipline a little bit more than boulder per se. But I think that's, you know, this event also showed me that that's changing. Like I am becoming more proficient in the modern style and the work is paying off. So I don't know, in this past 12 months, I think my attitude toward bouldering has changed a little bit. And I think there's more room to grow in that discipline than I maybe thought there was.
I guess I'm kind of surprised that you think lead is still a little bit more old school, because they've definitely been setting some scary stuff for lead as well. Like I've seen some sketchy starts where you're just have to like start on a pretty big jump, or they've set some like cliche moves in the middle that could be kind of stopper moves. Do you feel like it's going towards this like new school style in lead as well, or is it just like it's all right?
Yeah, they're definitely implementing more sort of new school movements into lead. But at the end of the day, like the fact that you only have one go in lead and, you know, the split is as a result of, you know, exactly where you fall off on the route. I think like these sorts of low percentage moves that take a little bit of time to learn before you can do them just don't lend well to the scoring system within lead. So I think there's only ever going to be like so much room for new school parkour-y comp style moves in lead. And like, yeah, typically lead still comes down to like a matter of who's the fittest and who's the strongest and who can kind of hold on for the longest. And yeah, that's like part of lead climbing that I really, really enjoy. But you know, it's nice to have a few little crazy comp moves in there as well. But yeah, I think we're also seeing a lot of like athletes who are previously boulder specialists, especially like the more power centered boulder specialists, starting to perform a lot more consistently in lead than they perhaps were in bouldering to begin with. So, than they are in bouldering now, sorry. Yeah, so I think it sort of remains a little bit more old school out of the two.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, now back to the Australia stuff. How do you feel about it being a developing sport in Australia, and also in general, just like Australia being kind of far from everything, and like the long travel? I feel like I've heard that's a pretty big issue. How do you deal with those sorts of things?
Yeah. As far as like the development of climbing within Australia, I think you'd maybe be hard pressed to find a country where climbing is growing faster than in Australia. I think like the number of gyms that have appeared in just the last 5 years is mind blowing. And so it's growing really fast, which presents its own set of problems in terms of like, yeah, the development of climbing as like a high performance sport. If the, you know, certain aspects of the sport are growing way faster than others. So that's really complex in and of itself. And we're not really seeing like the growth of climbing flow into like support of high level athletes yet. So that plays into the issue of Australia being just generally speaking really, really far away from the majority of the comp climbing circuit, which adds a lot of barriers to people who are like to aspiring competition climbers. You know, I always feel quite jealous of like Europeans who, for them, going to a World Cup is like a weekend away from home. And then for us, going to a World Cup is like, okay, well, I'm not going to be able to save for a deposit on a house this year because, you know, I have to pay the equivalent of a mortgage to like go and do this thing. And it's my dream. No one's making me do it. I'm choosing to do it. You know, just wanting to like, just silly things like, oh, I'd love to buy a new bike, or I'd love to buy a new laptop, or, you know, oh, I haven't replaced my phone in 6 years, 8 years, whatever. Like, those are all things that just have to go on hold just as a result of climbing being, of Australia being so far away from the rest of the climbing scene. So it can be tough sometimes. But again, like I said, you know, no one's making us do it. So sometimes you have to swallow that pill and just keep on keeping on.
Do you end up kind of like staying in Europe for a while? I think you mentioned you stayed for like 3 months before.
Yeah, the way I've found works best for me is if I can pick a city, usually Innsbruck in Austria, and rent an apartment, like, or sublet an apartment from somebody, rather than paying like the extortionate Airbnb fees. Just paying like a standard monthly rent for a room and keeping that room for like a whole 3 months. And then you can treat World Cups as like a more of like a weekend or a couple of weeks. You go away, you do the World Cups, you come back to the home base where you've got, you know, all of your creature comforts and your luggage and whatnot. Rather than like moving around a lot and paying a lot for really expensive accommodation, or, you know, flying to Europe, coming back, flying there again. I like to keep that home base. It's just like a little bit cheaper and a little bit like logistically easier, I think, for me.
Do you ever like stay and train in Europe, or is all your training done back in Australia?
No, I'll usually try and prepare for the World Cups in Europe, at least that last 2 to 4 weeks before I start my season. I'll try to train in Europe, but you know, there's a It's a very clever, careful balancing act because, you know, you only have a certain number of days that you can stay within the Schengen zone, the like European visa zone without having an extended visa. And so, you know, you've got to think like, okay, if I'm going to do these events, then I can train for 3 weeks before the World Cup season starts in Europe. But, you know, if I skip this event, I can do a little bit of extra training. Or if I skip the training, I can do a little bit, like a few more comps. So yeah, it gets quite strategic in that sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of planning that goes into it.
Yeah, definitely.
And how's like your training in Australia? Like, is it good for a lead or better for bouldering? Or do you have like coaches?
I would say I'll stick with, for the most part, training in Melbourne because that's where I live. I would say for bouldering, it's decent. It's hard to find like a lots of hard blocks to train on, but we have like quite a few nice gyms. I think you have to get somewhat creative with your training. It has to be quite structured because, you know, you're not going to have like all of the resources that you could want. But you know, if you've got like a decent spray wall and a fingerboard and, you know, a weights gym and that sort of thing, there's quite a lot you can do. For lead, it's gotten better in the last sort of year and a half. But still not great. I think unless a gym sets routes specifically for me, I would be hard pressed to find anything much harder than like 7C. 7C plus in a gym, which, you know, World Cup routes start at 8B plus. So, you know, most of my lead training will happen on a spray wall when I'm in Melbourne. Whereas when I go overseas, I like really take that opportunity to, you know, you go somewhere like Innsbruck where maybe there's like 30 routes, 8B and above, and you just try to...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner. So you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Get in as much as you can while you're there.
Yeah, do you have any thoughts on how to like grow the Australian team and how you think it could be better funded?
I think first and foremost, the Australian team needs more opportunities to train and climb together. I think since COVID blew up initially, I think we've had one training camp as a team, which was announced a week before the camp started. And I think we had maybe 5 or 6 people turn out, most of which lived in the city that it was being held. So yeah, the Australian team is like very disjointed. We don't get a lot of opportunities to come together and climb together and climb on like high level routes with high level route setting. Coaching is quite limited, so I think it would be, yeah, a lot of, it's really tough. And then the idea of like the funding stuff, that I've honestly no idea like how to grow the funding of Australian climbing. I think I'm so focused on growing the funding of Campbell's climbing, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think if there was like maybe more cohesion between like amongst the team, and then maybe more like cooperation between the team and the gyms, we might be able to get a little bit more going. But you know, like it is improving, it is getting better in some ways, and then it's like very stagnant in others.
Well, I guess like stagnant in what ways? Just like the setting, or
we're growing in terms of the caliber of our athletes, but stagnant in terms of things like those training camps, training events, having consistent competition schedules as well. Like for this year, we didn't have a lead nationals, and we ended up having to have a lead selection, which was just like a sort of tailored down version of a lead nationals with only a qualification round. You know, it happened at from like 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. on a Friday, you know. So, yeah, it's quite interesting that there's so many more gyms and like so much money within the climbing industry at a commercial level. But then, you know, we can't get venues to host a lead nationals for a couple of days or, you know, host a training camp for an afternoon, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's progressing in so many ways. And then in other ways, yeah, not much change is really happening, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm actually not sure if it's if there's a lot of money at the commercial level. I've heard a lot of commercial gyms actually struggle quite a bit just to like break even. Because I wanted to like own a gym at some point, or that was like a goal, and I looked into it a bit, and it seemed like you had to be pretty well off just to get it started.
Yeah. I think I just look at like we've got some like big franchises of gyms within Australia that like are opening sort of venue after venue. And I think also I do work part time at a climbing gym, so I get that little insight on the amount of people that are coming through some of the facilities. So I think, yeah, and I mean, and also just, you know, like I said, this year the increase in the number of climbing gyms that we have is kind of telling that there's something here, you know. But yeah, it hasn't translated into high performance just yet, which makes sense, and it'll come along. I just think we haven't figured out exactly what the next step is, and I'm not sure either what the next step is.
Yeah, hopefully it'll come. And that sort of reminds me of the Athletes Commission. I'm not sure if that has any bearing on how it can affect like climbing at like the Australian national level. But yeah, I was wondering a bit about the Athletes Commission and what, I guess, first of all, what is it? And why haven't we really heard about it? Because I feel like this is the first year that we heard anything about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's one of those things that I think when you're an athlete in the circuit, it's something that you know about and you kind of just assume that other people do. But I guess it's a very valid point that like up until now, how would the general public have known that there was an athletes commission, that, you know, every world championship we have a vote, you know, where there's like ballot papers and everything, or this year it was online. But yeah, basically the IFSC Athletes Commission is a collection of athletes that act as kind of like a advisory voice to the IFSC, and our president and vice president, Shauna Coxie and Sean McCall, sit on the IFSC board. So basically we have meetings every month where we discuss a myriad of different issues that pertain to athlete rights, whether it be considering like certain rules or the setup of venues, the way athletes are maybe treated within those venues, all sorts of things. Like sometimes you talk about the sustainability of events and whether or not we as athletes can support certain events going ahead in the way that they are. You know, we cover a lot of too many different topics probably for the amount of time we spend actually meeting together. But yeah, we advise Sean and Shauna on how we feel about certain issues, and then they present that feedback to the IFSC board. So yeah, for me, I decided to go for it at this year's World Championship because, as far as I know, we've never had an athlete from the Oceania region on the Athletes Commission before. And so I thought it was a really unique opportunity to give the perspective not only of my region, but just generally smaller climbing nations with less funding. I think we have like very different issues to some of the other nations. And so I thought it was really important that someone, you know, amongst that group of climbers was able to get in there. And I think I'm a relatively outspoken member of the climbing community, and because I've been solo for a lot of the World Cups, I'm quite well connected amongst the climbing community. So I thought I was in like a unique position to be able to hopefully, you know, get that position, which I end up doing, and being able to make a difference over the course of my term, and also just, you know, learn more about how the sport works in other places so that then I can hopefully impart that knowledge upon my own region and maybe, you know, answer some of these questions that we've been talking about so far that we don't really quite have the answers to yet.
Yeah, what kind of, I guess, causes are you hoping to champion as part of the Athletes Commission?
I think I would love to see the World Cup circuit be a bit more like geographically inclusive, you know, being laid out in a way that it makes a little bit more sense for athletes who don't live in Europe to, you know, be able to come participate in events in succession. I have like a notepad somewhere where I've written out a bunch of this stuff.
Please excuse this brief intermission, but I would just like to take some time and remind you that if you are enjoying this podcast, please follow and rate it on your preferred listening platform. If you're watching on YouTube, be sure to subscribe and hit the like button. Anything helps to push this podcast out to more people and get even more amazing guests on. Back to the show.
I had like a little brainstorm that I did when I signed up for the Athletes Commission and what I wanted to get out of being there. I think, yeah, for me, there were the sort of geographical inclusivity that we've been talking about. I think I'd like to see greater regulation of route setting practices within the sport. So kind of standardizing route setting a little bit. I think at the moment, route setters have a lot of freedom or the potential for a lot of freedom to influence results. You know, essentially what a competition looks like, what a round looks like is almost entirely up to the head route setter as to what they, you know, see climbing being like. And I don't think any of our route setters are trying to like influence the results of competitions, but nevertheless, like the potential for that to happen is there. More regulation, I guess, into what like climbing rounds should look like. What is the style of climbing? Like, what are these different disciplines trying to test? I also would like to see more growth made in terms of like athlete health, the sort of BMI Red S discussion as well. And just improving the like general treatment of athletes and the valuation of athletes, you know, within the sport at the end of the day. There's so many different roles that make climbing competitions happen. But at the end of the day, you know, climbing comps don't happen unless you have athletes on the wall putting on a show. And sometimes, you know, it doesn't feel like that's really acknowledged. You know, when you look at the prize pool that's put up for an IFSC event, for instance, or the fact that, you know, you'll have Janja Gambrit finishing a world championship and then having to walk out into a crowd of people, you know, swarming her and that sort of thing. And it's not really like safe or practical.
Yeah. The more that I think about it, the more I was like, not just in climbing, but all sports in general, how athletes are kind of a product, I guess, that people kind of just like view and watch for a bit. And then if they like age out or they get injured, it's kind of just like you're discarded now. You're like an old product. Does it kind of feel like that?
Yeah, that's product is a really good word for it, because I think at the moment we're viewed as products, or sometimes I feel like we're even viewed as consumers. Like we come to the event and we like the event is put on for us, despite there being we're standing in a stadium of thousands of people. Sometimes it feels like the events are put on for us and we should be just like grateful that this is happening so that we can do the thing we want to do, which in some cases is true. But on the other hand, like we're also almost like employees of climbing, you know, like we're in some ways the performers that are putting on the show. You know, these thousands of people are coming to these stadiums to watch us perform. And so, yeah, there's like a little bit of a disconnect there, I guess. But I think product is a really good word for it, you know, where we're viewed as like, yeah, the end product that's put out there, when really we're, like, you know, it's on the basis of our labor that these events are able to draw in the crowds that they do, I guess.
Yeah, it's a little bit dark though, but I guess these are all issues we should try to solve.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
You also mentioned about route setters and keeping everything more consistent. I always wondered if it would ever happen where someone would like pay off a route setter or like bribe them to set so that someone could specifically win.
Oh, look, it's one of those topics that's really hard to get into without putting your foot in your mouth. I think there are certainly events in the past where you can look back on and you see some things happening that are just a little bit suspicious. But I think also just the idea that like a particular route setter who might be head route setter could say internally, you know, oh, this athlete I really like, or this athlete I've, you know, potentially been paid off to set for is really good at this style. There's nothing stopping me from setting this style on every single boulder if I as the head route setter want that to be the, you know, the vibe of the competition. So, you know, just more regulations put in place that ensure a diversity of boulders across a round, you know?
Yeah, interesting. I kind of brought that up as just like a thought. I didn't know it had actually happened.
You know, I don't want to, of course, like name any names or point any fingers, but yeah, the potential to influence the results of climbing competitions through the route setting is very real. And so I think that that's something we need to think about. While the sport is a bit younger, we have a good opportunity to like build a base, you know, upon which we have safe and fair competitions rather than the sport getting bigger and bigger and bigger before we've kind of put those foundations in place. And it's maybe harder to implement them further down the road.
Sort of related to that, do you feel like, so I guess that's sort of in reference to maybe specific like competitions, but in general with like the boulder and lead combined format, do you feel like they've been doing a pretty good job of keeping that even?
I think so. I've been pleasantly surprised with how much I've enjoyed watching the combined format and how much I like look forward to competing in the combined format. I think at first when I saw the like point system, I thought it seemed a little bit like a game show or something. It seemed a bit silly that like, oh, you get, you know, this many points for doing this and that many points for that. And I worried that, you know, it would favor one discipline over the other. But like ultimately, I think you really do have to be good at both, because in any given round, the boulder round might be worth more, the lead round might be worth more. So like you have to be prepared to perform in either of them. And yeah, so far I think it's been like really interesting to see how different rounds maybe sway a bit more towards one discipline or the other, but it seems to balance out in a sense. Like I haven't seen, you know, that like, yeah, you have to be good at both at the end of the day. And I think that's like really cool to watch, that you've got to be ready to take the opportunity in either round.
Yeah. I mean, definitely cool to watch. I don't know how it's like actually having to do that and experience it as an athlete. But yeah, going back to Athletes Commission, do you feel like the IFSC listens to the athletes, either like within Athletes Commission or outside of Athletes Commission?
I think being a part of the Athletes Commission is very new for me. I think I'm really yet to see whether or not our voice is heard. Just because, you know, we haven't really, I just haven't really had any instances yet where we've presented something like really big and really important to the IFSC, and they've kind of had the opportunity to respond. The IFSC could probably seek out feedback a little bit more than they already do from the athletes and from the athletes commission. But at the same time, like, I am seeing work happen to improve that, like to improve the communication between the athletes and the IFSC. So yeah, I think my perspective is kind of still pending on that question. Well, you know, ask me in a year maybe and we'll see how I feel about it.
Okay, yeah, we'll follow up. Yeah, another one of the things that you mentioned being on your list of things to talk about in terms of Athletes Commission is the Red S issue. And I mean, I know that's something everyone's talking about, and hopefully they will be taking some kind of action on it. I guess that's still to be determined. But you also mentioned that you've sort of had your own experience with it. Is that something that you'd want to go into?
Yeah. Like, it's definitely something I'm happy to talk about, because I think it's really easy to look at the minority of athletes who lose a ton of weight and see huge increases in their performance. Whereas I think the experience of quite a lot of us is that we fell into really negative habits around eating and trying desperately to lose weight and being as small as possible, and just kind of crashed and burned in a lot of senses. I think for every athlete who loses 5-10 kilos and becomes a superstar World Cup winner, there's probably 10, 20, 30 athletes who lost a bunch of weight and ended up in the hospital, or ended up quitting climbing and not competing, or not, you know, reaching their goals and having a myriad of mental and physical health problems. And so I think that's kind of more my experience of like, well, not so much my experience, because obviously I'm still climbing and I'm still climbing well, but I think my experience of when I was suffering through my eating disorder was, yeah, just having so much trouble, like maintaining my mood, maintaining my training, maintaining my weight, like all of these fluctuations and all of these issues. And I think, it's quite damaging, I guess, to paint Red S in the light that it has been painted in, that it's like this shortcut to success. Whereas I think in a lot of instances, it's quite the opposite. It's quite like destructive to people's climbing careers.
Well, I had no idea that it was so common. Like, when you were experiencing it, were you like aware that you were doing it, or was it just kind of like the side effect of the sport and it just didn't even, I guess, like register to you that you were doing something harmful?
I think in a lot of ways, having an eating disorder felt mandatory in the sport. And I know how like horrible and dark that sounds, but like, it felt like if I was turning up to a competition and I didn't look thin enough, then people would assume that I didn't care enough, or that I wasn't, that I wasn't dedicated. I think there was a lot of discussion and a lot of rhetoric around, oh, this is how little I eat leading up to a competition, or, oh, like, I'm doing so well today, I haven't eaten since blah, blah, blah. And I think that's changing in a lot of ways now that we're actually like having the discussion and it's becoming more like publicly known, these sort of darker aspects of the sport. But yeah, I think it felt like in the community that I grew up in, it kind of felt like it was something that I had to be doing, and that's sort of how I fell into it, and really like started to struggle with it, I guess.
Oh wow. So it was like an actual discussion amongst athletes, like this is something that you guys would talk about?
Yeah, I think so. Not when it started. I think it was just, I felt like it was very much just this like number on the scales that I wanted to push down, and felt very objective in that sense. And then it kind of started to develop into more of like an emotional like weighting on the number on the scale. But yeah, I definitely know, like, I remember a lot of instances within the sport, yeah, where people would be having these discussions of like, you know, yeah, I don't eat between this time and this time, or I only eat this many calories in a day, or, you know, in the however long before the competition, I'm trying to lose this much. And while these discussions are happening, like what you're seeing, like what I'm seeing in front of me is athletes, you know, getting worse and worse and worse at their climbing and having these like massive detriments to their performance as they're like desperately chasing the lowest number on the scale that they can. And then what people are telling you is that, oh, eating disorders are terrible in climbing, but they get you really good. You're going to be really like, you know, it's really strong when I was as light as possible, but you know, then it was really bad for me. But then I think like, that's not actually really the case. Like, I think a lot of climbers who have tried to lose a lot of weight or have these.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Struggles with eating and with their body image and such, like, tend to see a lot more detriment than benefit, in actual fact. But that's not really like the narrative that we see around it.
How did you sort of get out of that, the eating disorder for yourself?
Like I said, it started off as this like very objective goal to just like reduce the number on the scale. And then it started to turn like a little bit more emotional. I had more of like a, like an emotional connection to like whether I was perceiving myself as light enough to be, you know, a self-respecting professional climber or whatever. And then that for me turned into a quite a, serious like binge eating issue. So binging, restricting, and that's sort of the pattern you see with a lot of climbers is, trying really hard to adhere to these like rules that these climbers are setting of, you know, not eating this much or not eating, you know, these times, whatever it might be. And so you, you fall into these patterns of working really hard to try and be as thin as possible. Eventually you can't keep up with this, image of perfection you set yourself, and you slip up and you binge, and then you think, oh, that was a horrible mistake. I have to erase what I've done. And so you restrict harder, which then means you binge harder because, you know, your body just, it doesn't let you start, like in a lot of instances, it just won't let you starve yourself like that. And so I think for me, I had to just like completely, I had to like completely break the cycle and learn to, like, if I had these, like these binges, these slip ups, I had to just, learn to accept that they'd happened and that they didn't, it wasn't a mistake that needed to be rectified or fixed, that it was my body telling me that it was underfueled and under-resourced and that I needed to, if I had like a slip up and I felt like, and I had a binge, it was because I wasn't treating my body with the respect it needed. So rather than depriving it even more, what I needed to do was give it that respect. And then eventually over the course of years managed to sort of, for the most part, heal that relationship between, you know, my body and my mind and my perception of myself. And I still have more difficult days, more difficult periods, but yeah, just learning to see those signs and like act accordingly, I guess, if that makes sense.
It's a very personal journey, so I think Everyone goes through it differently, but it's good to hear that you've mostly worked through it, and hopefully it's not still going on, especially with all the attention that's been brought to it. I think people are just a lot more on alert in like the public and hopefully among athletes as well.
Yeah, it is a very complicated topic and it is very full on. I've talked about it a lot on like my social media, but I guess I learned to just like incorporate the joy of food just into my my like daily routines, and learning that if I felt like I was falling short of my goals within food, it was probably because my body was trying to tell me something. And like learning to actually listen to my body and respect those messages that my body was giving me, rather than thinking my body was something that I had to fight against, that like feelings of hunger or feelings of being unsatiated was something that I had to battle against. It's actually your body trying to tell you something, and you can probably get a lot more out of listening to those messages than, you know, fighting against them.
These days, do you still hear that kind of talk between athletes where it's like about how little you've ate or things like that?
Definitely not to the same. No, I think the rhetoric has changed a lot, honestly. Like, weight management and weight loss is a part of climbing at the end of the day. I think it's silly to pretend that it's not. And like, it's something that as an athlete, you do have to be aware of, I guess, you know? But I think the discussions are becoming a lot healthier. And I think the discussions I've been having with athletes are a lot more about what I've been saying is, you know, rather than like in the past, it might've been like, oh, when I am really hungry, I do this to make myself not hungry anymore. Or when I feel like I've eaten too many calories, I'm going to do this to get rid of those calories. That kind of used to be the discussion. And now the discussion is more about like, yeah, oh, when I'm feeling this way, I remember that this is my body trying to tell me something and that I need to change what I'm doing, or I'm going to start to, you know, fall down a slippery slope. I think it's a lot healthier, the discussion around it, which is an important step. But then at the same time, I think that doesn't mean that athletes aren't also suffering in the background. You know, you can say one thing and then also be struggling.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear that it's improved a bit. And also related to this, had a Discord question come through asking what dichotomies, if any, are there in regards to the impact of Red S between men and women competition climbers?
This is another really interesting aspect of it as well, because I think the pressures to be like small are similar across male and female athletes. I think in the discussions around Red S, though, people tend to be more critical of women. Which I mean, lo and behold, that's kind of how our society is in general. People are more critical of women. But yeah, with regard to Red S, there's a lot more discussion of like how female athletes look and whether they look too skinny. They look like, you know, oh, she has a problem, you know, she is anorexic. But then in actual fact, I think the problem is just as big, if not bigger, within the men. But because we, you know, when we lose weight, we maintain our muscle mass a lot more easily. So our general shape doesn't change. We still have like these big biceps and big shoulders. And so people think that like, it's not as much of a problem within the men. But from my experience, that's just not the case. And I think we see a lot of men, if not more men with dangerously low body fat levels, as opposed to the women who look thin but maybe aren't necessarily suffering those like Red S symptoms. And so I think that's why developing screening is really important, because you can't just tell if someone's sick by looking at them.
Yeah, I think that also brings up the important point that it's not great to discuss people's bodies, whether or not you think that it's concerning, because there might not be an issue.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's really complicated to like, because, you know, if you're going to bring up the fact that you think there is an issue with like climbing athletes being underweight, that's like inherently bringing bodies into the conversation. But yeah, I think it needs to be like a little bit more nuanced than this person looks like they're sick. You know, it needs to be a little bit more objective and scientific than that, I guess.
Yeah. And it's hard to do that just looking through a screen.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Yeah. But yeah, was there anything else you wanted to touch on in terms of Red S? Because otherwise we're just going to totally shift gears to maybe something a little happier.
Yeah, no, I know. What a depressingly sad topic. No, I mean, unless you have any more questions about it, like, yeah, I think it's a huge issue within climbing that we need to get on top of. And I think, you know, having, like we talk about not judging people's bodies, but then at the same time, a lot of these athletes are the role models of the sport. And I think, you know, my inclinations as a young person towards trying to lose weight, a lot of them came from looking at the athletes who were leading the way, like who were, you know, at the tops of podiums and things, and seeing their body types and feeling like I needed to adhere to some kind of version of that as well. And so, you know, if we're allowing athletes who embody, you know, if we're allowing like red S athletes who embody these sort of like negative weight loss principles to represent the sport, then the problem is just going to like self-perpetuate. So, you know, I think we've got to do something to change the perception that people have of climbing. You know, it might involve restricting the participation of certain athletes who meet certain criteria within the sport.
Yeah, well put. And thanks for going into your own story. I know that's always not always easy to share and open up in that way. So appreciate that. But yeah, let's switch gears into something that's hopefully a bit less sad. Let's look forward to the Olympics that are coming up and the qualification process. I guess first of all, you had also wanted to, I mean, you were competing at the time when the 2021 Olympics were happening. And I saw a podcast that you did a long time ago that was before the qualification process for that. I forget if it was before COVID or not, but we all know that you did not end up representing Australia for the 2021 Olympics. So what happened in the qualifying process there?
It's funny. So this is also like a very sad, depressing topic.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm happy to get into it if you want to. But it's also like, yeah, it was bizarre. It was a bad time.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's if you want to.
Oh yeah. I'm happy to discuss it. Yeah. Yeah. Just if you wanted to like get into something more fun, like it's not really that fun.
Okay, we'll do the fun part after.
Yeah. So basically, going into the qualifications for the Tokyo Olympics, I was also the first seeded athlete, so I was the highest ranked athlete going into those qualifications. And then the pandemic hit, and the event got cancelled/postponed. And so essentially, the way the selection criteria worked was that if the event got cancelled, I was qualified for the Olympics. If the event went ahead, then it was obviously going to be a competition, and whoever won the event was going to go to the Olympics. But the problem there was that because within Australia and New Zealand, everything was so tightly locked down, the borders were so tightly controlled that running an event wouldn't necessarily mean that everybody would get to compete. So it was quite like a difficult time with things going back and forth. Like the event was happening, then it wasn't, then it was, then it wasn't. And you know, eventually we got to the point where the event was going ahead, and we all got there. The first day went kind of badly for me. I think I false started in the speed, which meant that I was like, I had like the worst ranking in the brackets for the finals event. And then we were sitting in my hotel room. I was sitting there in my hotel room with my partner, watching the news before the finals started. And they announced on the news that the borders would be closing between all the states across Australia, meaning that basically you either had to like, because we were in Sydney and I live in Melbourne, so we were going to have to leave Sydney to get back over the border in time, or either be stuck in Sydney or have to like go through a 2-week hotel quarantine scenario. And my older sister at the time had just been diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. And so my parents really wanted me home to spend Christmas with my family and with my sister before she started chemotherapy, before she started her treatment. And so I went to the competition, I went into finals for isolation, and I had no idea what to do. And I was in tears the whole time, went out to climb, didn't do well in the speed round, and like ultimately made the decision that I would leave the event, go home to be with my family, because I wasn't sure if I would be able to qualify, and I couldn't decide. It was just a horrible, tough decision. So at the end, I left the event. And then at the end of the event, I think out of the 20 athletes that were initially slated to compete in the men's round, only 7 men, I think, ended up finishing the competition, and maybe even less women. So that was a really, really tough call, and something that I grappled with for a really, really long time afterwards. And I look back and I still don't even really know if I made the right decision on whether or not I should have stayed and stuck it out and dealt with those consequences or gone home and been with my family. But I think now I look back at it at the end of the day, it is what it is. What happened, happened. Tom O'Halloran, who did qualify for the spot, was super deserving as well. Whether or not I'd stayed, he was absolutely, had exceptional chances to take that spot like he did in the end. So that was a super, super tough time. The whole process going into it was really, really hard. A lot of back and forth and people saying things online and all sorts of stuff. And it was really, really tough. But then afterwards, I once the process of trying to qualify was over, I was able to really grow from that and ended up having some really, really great World Cup seasons. So, there's positives to take from it, but it was it was a pretty full on experience over the course of a year or so, I think.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, gosh, I'm sorry to hear that. I hope she's doing better now.
Yeah. She's still, the battle continues, but she's doing well.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear at least. We wish the best for her.
Oh. Yeah. Like I said, also a very kind of depressing topic for the podcast. So yeah, we can move on to happier stuff as well if you want to.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing. I think usually when people look back on these things, they're usually happy about making the decision to stick with family, especially in hard times. And I mean, you have another chance now, so.
Yeah. And so it was, I think it was quite interesting coming into this Olympics this Olympic selection process, is there was definitely a little bit of trauma from the last time, mm-hmm. of that whole process happening. But I was able to recognize that, this is something that I really want. And I was really excited about this process rather than last time where it was so full of dread and grief and indecision. This time it's been filled with so much passion and ambition. And I'm really excited about this opportunity. And, if I don't qualify in November, then I'm also really excited about the opportunity to get to do the Olympic qualifier series next year, hopefully. And so it's just as sad and depressing and whatever as that whole last experience was, and everything that I was going through at that time, I'm so much healthier and so much stronger and happier now, that this process so far has been really joyful, which is such a juxtaposition to the last one. So I'm super grateful in that sense.
Yeah, that's really great to hear. And how do you feel about competing this time without the speed discipline being added into everything?
Oh, so good. So good. I think that was also part of the last process, was that I had a really hard time making up my mind as to whether or not I actually wanted to do the combined format. I really appreciate and respect speed climbing, but it's just not for me. Mm-hmm. And so, that was also something I was grappling with through that whole process, is as hard as it was, my heart wasn't completely in it. Mm-hmm. Whereas this time with the lead boulder combined, those are the disciplines that I fell in love with. And so, my heart really is in this one 100%, and I'm able to enjoy the process of it. As a result, not just not just looking towards the outcome, but also enjoying the journey.
It's a little bit of a shame as a viewer, just because it was actually pretty fun watching non-speed climbers and seeing how well they could do on the speed route, since it's just so much more, I guess, like consistent, and you can, yeah. It's just like interesting to see. So, But I understand, of course, like it's not, people don't really want to do it if they're not into it.
Yeah. And I'm glad that the speed climbers get their own medal this time, because I think that combined format like really shafted them.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, it's really nice that they get to have their own set of medals this time, and I think everyone's a little bit happier for it. I think we'll be even happier when the three disciplines are split. This combined format is fun. I think it's really cool. I think it's fun to watch, and like I'm enjoying it so far.
Yeah. Do you have hopes for it getting split in like LA games?
From what I understand, that's the plan, is to get three medals for the LA games. And that, yeah, it'll be quite cool. Like also, you know, having multiple opportunities to claim an Olympic spot as well. Like you claim a spot in Boulder or lead rather than just the one for both. That's like quite cool as well. Cause it is a lot of pressure to, you know, just try and perform really well across both disciplines and to take one spot.
Yeah. Do you think if it is split in the future, you'll try for both?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's my plan. That's something I'll probably have to decide, you know, come the next selection cycle. But I think I would like to try and qualify for both. But at the end of the day, I'm much more of a lead specialist than a boulder specialist. And so if I feel like also doing bouldering is going to be detrimental to my chances in lead, that might impact my decision. But I've always done both, so I would imagine that I would still try to do both.
Okay. Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see how things change, because I would think a lot more people will probably try to just focus on one. And then it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Because, I mean, a lot of people are great at both right now. And I wonder what it would look like if they just focused on one, all of their energy onto one. If it'd be like unstoppable.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also really curious to see what people do. I think there are probably a few more, generally speaking, there are more like boulder specialists than there are lead specialists.
Yeah.
So I wonder if like the participations across the disciplines will shift as well. But yeah, I guess we'll see when it happens, you know.
You got to think about some strategy going into that. But yeah, I think that's quite in the future, another 5 years, so we have some time. Thinking about the upcoming one, how do you think your training would change if you qualified in the Oceania Championships versus if you had to wait again until OQS?
I think either way, I'll be taking a little break right after that comp, which will be nice. And then the season will start again. Either way, the season will start up again quite soon. I think if I'm competing in the OQS, the training will kick off sooner because the first OQS round is in like April or May, I think. But I mean, either way, my mindset at the moment is just to go in 110%. I think my chances of qualifying in the continental event are obviously exponentially higher than they are in the OQS, for instance. But the way I look at it now is just whatever happens, I'm going to be 110% committed to either competing in the Olympic Games or grabbing a ticket at the OQS. And I want to finish feeling like I didn't leave anything behind. So I don't think there'll be too many changes to my approach in that respect.
Well, we're rooting for you.
Yeah, thank you.
What do you think? What's considered a break for you? Because I feel like a break for proper athletes is very different from what I consider a break.
Well, I have like a little trip to New Zealand planned where I think I will do little to no climbing. Usually a break will be like 1 to 2 weeks of no climbing at all, and then maybe 1 to 2 weeks of climbing when I want to. Or it's kind of what I do. When I say I'm taking a break, I just climb as much as I feel like climbing. I think, like, if I wasn't an athlete, I probably wouldn't climb quite as much as I do. You know, like, I wouldn't be doing like double sessions 5 days a week, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'd probably just be climbing, you know, like 3 to 4 days a week for a couple of hours and trying the boulders that I think are fun and that sort of thing. So yeah, a break is just like embracing that side of myself. And sometimes I get to the end of a season, I have like 3 days off and I'm like, no, I want to go climbing. And then I think last year I got to the end of my season and I took 2 weeks off with no climbing and I had to like force myself to go back because, okay, it's time to start training again. So it depends, but I just, you know, I just go with the flow and do what feels right.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Okay, well, I'm excited to watch you climb. Hopefully it'll be streamed and easy to watch.
Yeah, there should be a live stream on YouTube. I think that'll be open access for everybody.
Awesome. Okay, yeah, excited to watch. And now going into the last section, a few Discord questions. I already went through a few while we were just talking, but we have, I think, three others that either just like didn't really fit. So the first one, this one I actually have no idea about. It relates to climbing in Australia, I think outside as well. I don't know how much outside climbing you do.
I don't tend to climb outside a lot these days. When I was in my teens, I did a lot of rock climbing, but nowadays, not so much.
Okay. Well, you probably still have a bit of insight into it. You feel like climbers are used as an easy target by state governments in regards to Aboriginal heritage because they're a societal outgroup and it deflects away from other more severe sources of harm to Aboriginal communities, such as the mining industry?
Ooh. I'd say yes and no. Yes and no. I think there are definitely people within certain organizations that do use climbing as as a scapegoat to, yeah, either reduce access to certain areas or, yeah. But I think at the same time, you know, climbing and climbers need to acknowledge, you know, the role that we play in the protection of First Nations heritage within Australia and within other countries as well. And, you know, sometimes that is going to mean like not climbing in certain areas. I think anyone who's been to the Grampians, who's climbed in crags like Kindergarten or Muline or the Gallery, you know, you look at these caves and it's impossible to think that over the course of 90,000 years of history that people haven't lived and died in these caves and, you know, that they aren't sacred spaces. And I think, you know, to some degree, bolting them and covering them with chalk and doing whatever we do, you know, is to some degree desecrating these places that were taken by First Nations people through horrific genocide. So, I think it's important that as climbers, we acknowledge the role we have to play. And sometimes it's going to mean not climbing in certain areas. I think on the other hand, though, there are instances where state bodies maybe we could be putting in a little bit more work to ensure that we are keeping climbers out of the right areas and then still providing everybody access to areas that are like safe for us to recreate in without damaging cultural heritage, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I guess for context, what are some of the restrictions that have been put in place?
A lot of the Grampians has just become subject to straight up no climbing bans, or certain areas you can only climb in if you have a like a guide with you. I definitely wouldn't say I'm like a foremost expert on this topic, but yeah, I think different people within different organizations have varying ideas of what climbers should and shouldn't have access to. And I think some of which is very, very valid. Like some of these climbing spaces are quite close to like protective cave paintings and like sacred sites. And yet, like I said, it makes sense that we unable to climb in those spaces because, you know, white European settlement only came to Australia within the last like two centuries. So we have to be respectful of the land that we've, you know, that we find ourselves upon. But yeah, at the same time, I think there's also, yeah, there's room to like make these assessments of these places and ensure climbers that, you know, where it is safe for us to climb, that we will have access to those spaces.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah, next question. What are your thoughts on Eubank grading? I think it's far easier to understand than most other grading systems, and being open-ended is a bonus that avoids the muddled lower end of our UK trad grades. So if you could also go into what the grading system is like, because I'm not very familiar with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you kind of hit like the nail on the head a little bit in that the Eubank grade is just like super easy. It's just a number system. So like, for instance, I think a 8A, you know, European sports grade is a 29 in Australia. 8A plus is 30, 8B is 31, so on and so forth, 32, 33, 34. Although I feel like because I spend so much time climbing overseas, I tend to default into the European grading anyway. I think, at the end of the day, grading is all subjective and it kind of ends up equating more or less to the same thing anyway. I think it is kind of nice that Eubank doesn't have these like cluster grades, you know, in the same way that the United States have got like 513, 514, like you have these brackets. The Eubank system just kind of progresses point by point. But like grades are grades. It's all much for muchness in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And last question, something we actually didn't touch on too much, but this is your chance to go into it if you want. I'm interested in your views on pro climbing and queerness. Is it an easy community to be openly LGBTQ plus in? And how does it feel competing in countries where it's frowned upon or illegal? I believe one of the OQS is in the Middle East, for example.
I think that for the most part, I found the climbing community quite accepting of like me as a queer person. That's not to say that there like isn't homophobia and discrimination within the community. And I think that's more accentuated at the international level, because like you said, you know, you have this mixing pot of all these different cultures and, you know, yeah, some people are going to feel less strongly about your human rights, you know, love who you love and that sort of thing. And it can be quite scary. Like, I was competing in the world championships in Russia a few years back, and it can be quite scary, like that, like I'm someone who paints my nails, and you know, maybe someone on the street might, you know, see that as a sign that I'm a queer person and have an issue with it, or that people will see me and my partner at a competition and have an issue with that. So like there are definitely like certain aspects to it that we as queer people have to like take into consideration a little more than others do. But yeah, for the most part, I think my experiences as a queer climber have been quite positive. I think most of the controversy comes in when I try to discuss like my queerness and my athleticism or my climbing kind of in the same vein. I can sometimes get a lot of negative feedback, and that people saying that like you know, being gay doesn't have anything to do with climbing. But at the end of the day, like they're two important facets of who I am, and so like they are, you know, none of it exists in a vacuum. So yeah, it's an interesting interplay, I guess.
Has it ever like affected you to the point where you have to sort of consider if a competition is one that you would want to go to?
Yeah, I definitely had like an internal battle, I guess, with regard to like whether or not I would go and compete in Russia. Or I was Like I'm an ambassador for an organization in Australia called Proud to Play. And one of the things that I have of theirs is I have this, it's just like a towel. Like every athlete comes out to a bouldering round almost with a towel. They can clean their shoes and stuff. And my towel has a pride flag on it. And, you know, there are some countries where I'm like, oh, I don't know if I should come out onto the field wearing this pride flag. But then at the same time, maybe it's even more important that I come out onto the field wearing a pride flag in some of these countries. So yeah, it's, you know, it's something that I have to think about. And I think the OQS round in the Middle East got cancelled in the end. I think now it's just Shanghai and Budapest. But it is something that I have to think about when, you know, comes to making a decision about which comps to attend to and which not.
Yeah. And did they replace it with a different location, or it's just gone?
Unfortunately, we're just going to have two rounds of the OQS now, which is good, because for a little while, I think the fear was that there was going to be one round. As far as the dates that have been confirmed at this stage, yeah, it'll be the two rounds of the OQS. So a little bit shorter than the planned three, but should still be good.
Okay. All right. I think that's all of the questions I had. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on?
Yeah, it's been fun. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on board. And I'm glad we managed to get together and like have this chat. And
yeah,
I'm looking forward to, seeing the full piece.
Yeah. Thank you for joining me. Is there anything you want to like shout out or let people know where they can find you?
Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to follow me, you can find me on Instagram at Campbell_Harrison547. That's probably the best way to keep up with what I'm doing. I think that's everything. Unless you have any more questions, I'm happy with that.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you again. It was amazing to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, I would love to hear your discussion and thoughts in the comments below. And don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. If you're listening through a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars, and you can continue the discussion through my competition climbing Discord, linked in all of the descriptions through all the platforms. Thanks again for listening.